From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Joan Plowright is starring in a new movie by Peter Greenaway, who also directed The Cook, The Thief, His Wife, and Her Lover. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Plowright about acting and about working with her late husband, Sir Laurence Olivier. Also today, film historian Kevin Brownlow tells us why the silent film era wasn't as innocent as you might think. And book critic John Leonard reviews the latest collection from Polish journalist Ryszard Kapuściński. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. The White House warned Iraq today not to use ground or air forces against Kurdish refugees who are fleeing the country. The Bush administration also announced it was stepping up efforts to provide aid to the refugees. NPR's Brian Naylor reports.
White House spokesman Marlon Fitzwater refused to elaborate on the scope of the warning, but other U.S. officials have said Iraq was specifically warned not to operate helicopters or fixed-wing aircraft against the refugees in the north of its country. Fitzwater said that since last week, some 145 tons of food, blankets, and other supplies have been airdropped to the Kurds who are fleeing Saddam Hussein's army. Fitzwater defended administration efforts to help the refugees.
The United States has been doing a lot, and we do want the American people to know that we are responding.
The administration has already pledged $11 million to the relief effort. Fitzwater said the White House will ask Congress for more money to the tune of, quote, millions of dollars. This is Brian Naylor in Washington.
The Iraqi Minister of Trade says Baghdad is handing out bread and baby milk to Kurds and Shiite Muslims who have returned to their strife-torn provinces. Minister Mohammed Saleh says Iraq has enough food for all refugees as well. He says trucks loaded with flour and other food leave the capital every day for northern and southern Iraq, where government troops brutally crack down on rebellions. The trade minister charges that rebels have looted and burned food stocks in Basra and other southern towns, and the government is trying to replace them. Israel today released more than 200 Palestinian prisoners in what it calls a goodwill gesture. About 1,000 others will be released over the next few days. Linda Gradstein reports from Jerusalem.
The prisoner release came as U.S. Secretary of State James Baker left Israel for talks in Cairo. Israeli Defense Minister Moshe Aaron said it was not done as a gesture to Baker, but for the upcoming Muslim holiday of Eid al-Fitr. Yet the large number of prisoners who will be released, a total of 1,200, shows the Israeli government was trying to prove to Baker that it wants to make progress on starting talks with Arab states. The prisoners released today had all served most of their sentences and none were convicted of murder. Most of them were from the West Bank. Israel's right-wing parties sharply criticized the move and said it will only lead to more violence. Two groups petitioned the Israeli Supreme Court to stop the prisoner release, but the court rejected their petition. Defense Minister Moshe Aaron said Israel will continue to ease restrictions in the occupied territories as long as the level of violence remains low. For National Public Radio, this is Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem.
The Soviet Republic of Georgia has called for widespread strikes today to protest the presence of Moscow's troops in the area. The Southern Republic declared its independence from Moscow only yesterday. The president of Georgia said that strikes would begin today on the railways, cutting off part of the rail system in the Soviet Union. On Wall Street, the Dow rose 1.5 points to close at 2874.50. This is NPR. The Space Shuttle Atlantis astronauts have been forced to stay in space another day. Gusty winds at Edwards Air Force Base in California prevented the landing. The crew has enough air, food, and water to stay in space for at least 2 extra days, and those supplies can be stretched. But NASA could try to land the Atlantis tomorrow at one of several backup landing sites, including Cape Canaveral, Florida. The shuttle lifted off from the Florida base 5 days ago. Funeral services were held today for U.S. Senator John Hines of Pennsylvania, who was killed last Thursday in a mid-air collision. Kevin Gavin of member station WDUQ in Pittsburgh reports.
500 invited guests attended the service inside Hines Chapel, which was a gift from the senator's grandfather to the University of Pittsburgh. More than 1,000 other mourners stood outside the chapel to hear the service on loudspeakers. A colleague, Senator John Danforth, who is also an Episcopalian priest, conducted the service. He said Hines worked for all people.
Old people, weak people, people whose lifelong jobs had disappeared. Those were the people he worked for with a persistence unmatched by anyone I have ever known.
Hines was remembered as a dedicated husband, father, and public servant. Among the mourners were Vice President Dan Quayle, more than a dozen senators, and Attorney General Dick Thornburg. For National Public Radio, I'm Kevin Gavin in Pittsburgh.
Dairy farmers and cattle ranchers are upset over a new report by the Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine. The group wants the Department of Agriculture to change the basic food groups to whole grains, vegetables, legumes, and fruit, using meat only as a flavoring, not as the meal's centerpiece. A spokesman for the Kansas Farm Bureau says he doesn't think the idea makes much nutritional sense. Other farmers say the doctors should first examine the role of junk food in the American diet. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Joan Plowright, is one of England's leading actresses, and she was married to one of England's finest actors, Sir Laurence Olivier, from 1961 until his death. Plowright is best known as a stage actress, but over the past few years, she's been making more movies. You may have seen her in the recent films The Dressmaker and Avalon. Now she's starring in Drowning by Numbers, a dark comedy about three women who drown their husbands. The movie was directed by Peter Greenaway, who also directed one of last year's most controversial films, the X-rated The Cook, the Thief, His Wife, and Her Lover. Drowning by Numbers, which was not submitted for a rating, was made before The Thief, the Cook. But I wondered if Plowright thought Drowning by Numbers would generate more controversy than it otherwise might have because of Greenaway's new notoriety.
I think it's equally controversial, whichever time it's shown. But I'm not sure that it isn't a little more accessible. You know, Peter Greenaway is obviously a very original and slightly outrageous film director. His films have always been controversial. In England, people admire, ever since The Draftsman's Contract, they've welcomed him and acclaimed that. They've been puzzled by his films afterwards, though in Paris and Germany and Sweden and everywhere else in Europe, they acclaimed all of the films. But England did sort of breathe a sigh of relief with Drowning by Numbers because they thought they could understand what was going on.
Are you used to saying lines like, "Are fat men's penises usually so small?"
No, I'm not. No, I must say, it's the first time I've ever said such a thing in my life. but I found it quite amusing.
Did you have any reservations about it? It just seems very, from the roles I've seen you in, it seemed very out of character.
Well, out of what character? I mean,
All characters, right, yeah.
Yes, I mean, I'm not what I play all
right.
The time. There is a bit of me in all of them. But, I can find that bit of me which finds that both outrageous and amusing to say a line like that. When I first got the script, I knew it was a fairly bizarre undertaking. Very outrageous, very exhilarating, a very literate script, and to me, a very multi-layered piece of work. I mean, it's a sort of high comedy, black comedy, but underneath there's quite some serious themes.
You started acting at the Old Vic Theatre School. What was the training like there?
It was a wonderful training, but it was very specifically for, I would say, classical theatre. It was to do with voice, speech, movement, dance, fencing. Even the girls learnt fencing. It was a very serious training and very tough. I mean, the end of each term at the Old Vic Theatre School where I trained, there were people who were told they should not continue. So it was very hard. It was very nerve-wracking. But it was a very sound and wonderful basic training.
Are you glad you learned how to fence? Has that come in useful for anything?
Well, I am glad, actually, because I played Viola in a television film of Shakespeare's Twelfth Night, and I did have to fence, because Violet dresses up as a boy, with Sir Ralph Richardson, who was playing Sir Toby. And we had quite a long sword fight, which was highly dangerous because he was no better at it than I was. But at least I'd had some training. I could look fairly good at it.
In Laurence Olivier's memoirs, he writes about the first time that you met. And he describes going backstage to congratulate all the actors at a performance of The Country Wife. And he is trying to imagine what your reaction was to him. And he says, "I divined that I stood for everything that the young generation at the royal court would find most objectionable, and everything that was most odious to a girl of this generation of actors who had come from North Lines. I was titled, necessarily self-satisfied, pompous, patronizing, having obviously come to visit in a spirit of condescension. I could see it all." What did you think about the older generation of actors and Laurence Olivier at the time? Was he accurate in those perceptions?
Half, yes. I mean, after all, we were very young. We had set up an outpost in Sloane Square at the Royal Court Theatre. We were doing the work of new contemporary writers of our own age, John Osborne, Harold Pinter.
Who is the we
Tom
that
Stoppard.
You're referring to?
The company. The we was the English stage company. It was actors like Albert Finney, Alan Bates, Peter O'Toole, girls, me and Billy Whitelaw. We were most of us from the provinces, not born in London, not with Kensington, London accents. We were from all over. And we, because of the success of John Osborne's play Look Back in Anger, we were all known as angry young men and angry young women. I mean, we weren't all that angry, but we did get lumped together, and that's why I say we at the time. That was a title that was used about me in interviews, even when I first came over to New York with A Taste of Honey. Obviously, you know, he represented a theatre that we were fighting to abolish.
What did you want to abolish?
Drawing room comedies, and where people came on in white flannels with a tennis racket and said, "Anyone for tennis?" It was that sort of theatre that we were trying to get rid of. We were political. We were very left-wing. And Larry, to us, I suppose, looked very right-wing. Now, that is not to say that one was not aware of a great talent. And I think what he saw when he came and said that about me was a thing that I was, along with my friends, determined not to be impressed just because he was coming to see us. We thought, quite right, he should come and see us. We've got something very good going here. At the same time, you don't have to make a decision to not to be impressed unless somewhere inside you, you are deeply impressed, if you see what I mean.
Right, exactly.
So that's your answer, really.
When did you change your mind about Laurence Olivier and decide that he wasn't just... You had pointed out you were already very impressed with him, but still he did represent the other generation and a more conservative spirit in the theatre.
Well, obviously it was when I started rehearsing the Osborne play The Entertainer with him, and here was a man who was nothing to do with the reputation, but... an actor, an entertainer, a huge talent on that stage, came on and took off his jacket and rolled up his sleeves and acted everybody off the stage with a force and a power and an energy that was very startling. Also a man who would, you know, just go next door into the pub with all the actors and talk as a human being. Getting to know him properly was a revelation, as against the image, which I think was a wrong image anyway, but which he couldn't help having achieved.
My guest is Joan Plowright, one of the leading stage actresses in England. She's also appeared in movies. You may have seen her in the recent films The Dressmaker and Avalon. She's starring in the new movie Drowning by Numbers, which is directed by Peter Greenaway, who also directed The Cook, The Thief, His Wife, and Her Lover. We'll take a short break, then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Actress Joan Plowright is my guest. Laurence Olivier, in his book on acting, reprints some of the letters that that he wrote to you with some advice to advice on acting to you about some performances. And he said to you in one of the letters, "You don't know how lucky you are to be able to cry at will on stage. I've never been able to do it in my life."
Yes.
Was that a problem for him? And was it something that you were especially proud of being able to do?
No, because honestly, a lot of people can, you know. It isn't a gift in any way. It's a weakness, perhaps. As far as he was concerned, I mean, he could make people believe that he was crying, perhaps more powerfully than actors who were actually crying. I mean, to be on stage, you know, it is an art form. It is a craft. I mean, you can play Juliet yourself in the bathroom, lying in the bath, and move yourself quite intensely and cry real tears. If you are actually on a stage and you do it in the same way, you are nobody beyond the first row in the theatre is going to know at all what you're doing. They are not going to see the tears. Your voice is going to be clogged with emotion anyway, so they're not going to hear. What Larry could do was project an image of somebody in great grief and crying without actually doing it. Now, that is great acting, and it is often more powerful than the real thing. That is in theatre we're talking about. On film, it would be totally different.
One other thing that Laurence Olivier wrote you in a letter that I wanted to mention, he wrote, "A humbler approach to our work is essential, but how do we equate the essential humility towards the work with the full possession of confidence required to carry it off?" And that just struck me as a really interesting dilemma, and I wonder if that's something you feel you've had to contend with during your career, the humility that you need to really approach a role and the confidence to pull it off, especially, you know, in the light of the fear of rejection that so many actors have. I think actors are very vulnerable about that.
Yes, you're right. It is, I mean, it is a constant problem. And it varies through stages in your life. Very early on, you probably have a great deal of confidence, but you, because you are still promising and you haven't yet had the knocks. I remember being interviewed by a journalist who said to me, "Why are you being so evasive with me?" He said, "You are a journalist's daughter. Surely you know the golden rule. We never knock you when you're on the way up. It's only when you get there that we'll shoot you down." Now, if that is a golden rule, it's not a very pleasant one, but it does seem to apply a great deal. And therefore, once you have achieved some kind of name or reputation, the nerves get worse. Therefore, the confidence gets more shaky because you have more to lose.
Was there a period in your life where you felt that that was really at its strongest, that sense of that you had the most to lose and your nerves were shaky?
Yes, quite possibly. At the opening of the National Theatre, where my first role was St. Joan, and that was really all right because I'd done that before. We repeated two plays from a previous season when we opened the National Theatre. But the next leading role I did, I think I was more worried and shaky in confidence in that I was playing Masha in Chekhov's Three Sisters, and Larry was directing it, and I had the sort of double responsibility of him as director and being my husband, and me as leading lady, and the worry that, you know, it was... the burden might be too much. So it was a shaky start to that.
What kind of reviews did you get for that?
They were actually marvellous, as it turned out. But, the rehearsal, the preparation was the fearful time.
It must be hard when you're getting directed by your husband in something, because, I mean, there's times, I think, when you really want to resist a director. And, I don't know, when you're that close, it must be hard to take direction in a way.
Yes, it does have its problems, but then, I mean, you have to be able to argue and not feel that, you know, for the sake of his reputation in front of the rest of the company, you can't say a word. You have to be very open about that and be able to argue as any actress would who was not married to him.
When you both fell in love and decided to marry, you were both married to other people.
Yes.
And Olivia was married to Vivian Leigh, and this was a very well-known relationship. And she had sent out a public statement saying that Olivia was asking for a divorce in order to marry you. And this was at a time when you were both performing in a play together.
Yes.
And it was decided that you should leave the production. I think Olivier suggested this. You should leave the production. After her statement became public, what was the reasoning behind asking you to leave?
Oh, because he knew the amount of press attention that would be there, and he didn't think I was aware of the of how much there would be, which, of course, I wasn't.
Looking back, do you think that that was the right way to handle it?
Yes, I believe it was. It would have been ridiculous for us both to have had to leave the theatre every night to crowds of photographers and people, wouldn't it?
What are some of the problems involved with having a relationship that's a very public relationship, whether you want it to be public or not, public in the sense that, you know, you're two public people who audiences want to know about?
That is a decision to take very early on. It was one of the reasons why we chose to live in Brighton, away from London, by the sea, that we could bring up our children in comparative privacy. And you can avoid it, you know, if you want to. If you wish to lead a rather secluded private life with only chosen friends, you can do so. The fact that we had to catch a train every night to Brighton from London, it was an hour's journey, put out of the way a lot of sort of social events that we might have been involved in otherwise, and which we didn't really want to be involved in. I mean, we were very, very determined to spend as much time as possible together. We had the house in Brighton by the sea, a flat in London, and a house in the country. And it was Brighton and the country where we spent a lot of time. We had a growing family. And really, you know, people who are very much in love and bringing up a family are not news value anymore as when they're having adulterous
right.
affairs and getting divorced. You know, they're not of that much interest. Their work is, but their private life, once it's settled, is not.
I think that's a very interesting point that you've just made. If you're just joining us, my guest is actress Joan Plowright, and she's starring in the new movie Drowning by Numbers. You took time off from theater to raise your children. You have three children?
Yes.
How much time did you end up taking away from acting?
Well, it was really only 18 months each time. I mean, once it was 2 years, I think, when I had each of the children. I wanted, obviously, that bond between mother and child to be there for the first 2 years if I could, without the kind of interruption of work. It was essential to me at that stage. For that time I did it, I didn't miss the excitement, the nerves, the nerve-wracking days of dress rehearsals and previews and openings. I felt a great relief at being away from it, but then suddenly it the urge came back.
Do you ever get out of practice when you haven't acted for a couple of years?
Yes, you do get out of practice. There's just that thing of, in theatre, for instance, of stepping onto a stage for the first time. If you haven't done it for 2 years, I remember going back into a play at the Old Vic. I took over from Maggie Smith in Much Ado About Nothing at the National Theatre. We often took over from each other in parts. And I hadn't been on the stage for 2 years. And I hadn't realised that this production started with the curtain up. And at a preview, I went into the wings just 5 minutes before the curtain was due to go up, as I thought, and walked on stage to practice my first line and saw an entire house full of people who all stopped talking to each other and looked expectantly at me. And I realised that the house was in, the curtain was up, and I was not starting the play, I was merely practising, ran off into the wings in great confusion. When the play did start and I came on again, my throat closed on my first line and I could not speak. And it stayed like that for, I suppose, 30 seconds of an epiglottal stop every time I tried to say the first word.
This is sounding very much like the classic actor's nightmare, but it actually happened to
you. Yes,
it
is. It did actually happen. Well, it never happened again because I was more careful, but that is that kind of shock to your system, a nervous system, coming back and being out of practice can do quite alarming things.
You've made some movies in America as well as in England.
Yes.
Do you think that there's a different approach to acting and directing in America?
Well, I mean, the film industry is America. I mean, it is America's tradition. It is America's medium. And it is therefore much more relaxed over here making movies. I don't think there's fundamentally a different approach. I mean, after all, convincing, truthful acting is the same in any country, whether English-speaking or not. An audience recognises the truthful performance. Directors and actors in America simply have far more scope and much more opportunity to practice their craft than in England, where the industry is very much beleaguered at the moment.
My guest has been Joan Plowright. She stars in Peter Greenaway's new film, Drowning by Numbers. Tomorrow, British rocker Graham Parker will be with us. Here's a song from his new album. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Somebody's life, I had a few moments to spare. He was a good man who lived with his wife, with the usual kids in his hair. There was happiness, a lot of weirdness, and a sprinkle of tragedy. I pulled it by chance from a secondhand bin, but it could have been written just for me.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer in personal computing, providing the power to be your best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. think of silent movies and you probably think either of slapstick comedy or romantic epics. But film historian Kevin Brownlow says silent films also dealt with the contemporary problems of the era, subjects like crime, racism, even sexually transmitted diseases. Coming up, Kevin Brownlow on the not-so-innocent silent era. Also, book critic John Leonard reviews The Soccer Wars, the new collection of writing by veteran Polish journalist Ryszard Kapuściński. John says even though the book deals with life in places like Africa and Latin America, it ends up also revealing a lot about Poland. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. In Turkey, there's been a clear indication that the situation on the border is not acceptable to Turkey or Iraq. NPR's John Hockenberry reports that the Turkish government is moving quickly to keep refugees from northern Iraq from remaining in Turkey.
The Turkish government has further mobilized its military in the border region with Iraq to create a buffer zone for refugees that the Allied coalition is apparently unwilling to establish. Turkish President Turgut Özal reportedly wants to make a buffer zone fully inside Iraq to move Iraqi refugees now in Turkey back to where they came from. Özal received a lukewarm reception for his plan from U.S. officials this week, but that hasn't prevented the Turkish army from increasing its presence in Iraqi territory in camps around the city of Çukurca. The Iraqi government announced today it has begun its own relief effort to aid the refugees. The question now is, will Turkey cooperate with Iraq to keep Kurdish refugees inside Iraq and controlled by military forces? This is John Hockenberry in Ankara.
Washington has warned Iraq not to use any planes in the northern part of the country against Kurdish refugees. The White House says the warning also applies to Iraqi ground forces. According to U.S. officials, the warning was passed on to Baghdad by diplomatic channels earlier this week. Iraqi forces have been using helicopter gunships against Kurdish rebels in northern Iraq. An official says the warning is designed to ensure that Iraq does not interfere in relief efforts to help hundreds of thousands of Kurdish refugees who have fled the fighting. Polish President Lech Wałęsa has warned businessmen in France that if they do not invest more in Central Europe, communism could return. He is currently on a two-day official visit to France, which is aimed at increasing Franco-Polish ties. Lynn Terry reports from Paris.
During a press conference with French President François Mitterrand, Lech Wałęsa said he's not satisfied with the amount of French investment in Poland. Paris is Warsaw's seventh trading partner, and it only has a 4% share of the total foreign investment in Poland. Wałęsa said the reforms that are now taking place in Poland offer good opportunities for businessmen, and he added that his country is well situated between the East and West. Mitterrand said France has done much to help the Polish economy. Last month, following a decision by Western creditor nations, it agreed to forgive 50% of Poland's debt to France. And on Sunday, Mitterrand promised to write off another 10%. Mitterrand said the political foundations have been laid for increased economic ties, and he said it was up to French businessmen to do the rest. For National Public Radio, this is Lynn Terry in Paris.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up over 1 point to close at 2,874.50 on volume of some 168 million shares. This is NPR News. Campaigning is now underway in Britain and Wales for local elections in campaigns that may determine if British Prime Minister John Major calls a general election this summer. 30 million people may vote in elections next month for 12,000 seats on local councils in most of England and Wales. Wins for the Conservative Party would increase chances of Major calling national elections in June, a year before the deadline. Campaigning is likely to be dominated by local taxes. Major's government did away with a highly unpopular poll tax in March and raised sales taxes to pay for the shortfall. In South Africa, Nelson Mandela telephoned Mangosuthu Buthelezi in an effort to try to ease the growing tensions between them. NPR's John Madison reports from Johannesburg that later, the two leaders issued conflicting interpretations of the phone call.
The African National Congress issued a press statement describing Mandela's call to Buthelezi as lengthy and cordial. It said Mandela explained that the ANC's ultimatum issued last week was aimed at the government, not at Inkatha. The ANC statement said both leaders agreed to lend their immense personal authority to ensuring that relations between the two movements are not disturbed by these developments. Later, Buthelezi issued his own statement. He said that Mandela had failed to add that Buthelezi had told him the ANC has put relations between the two organizations in a very difficult position, and his organization will now consider how to salvage South Africa from the crisis which the ANC's ill-considered letter has created. I'm John Matheson in Johannesburg.
And the government says that the nation's businesses plan to boost their plant and equipment investments by 3.2% this year, the smallest increase in 5 years. According to the Commerce Department, a survey conducted earlier this year found business planning to spend almost $541 billion for expansion. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. The silent film era has been celebrated for its innocence. But my guest Kevin Brownlow says the silent era recorded another America: gangsters, corrupt politicians, syphilis, discrimination, and unemployment. Brownlow's latest book, Behind the Mask of Innocence, is an attempt to set the record straight by examining films of social conscience in the silent era. For the most part, these are films that had been virtually forgotten until Brownlow rediscovered them. Brownlow is one of the world's leading silent film historians. He also collects and restores silent films. He restored Abel Gance's 1927 silent epic, Napoleon. MGM, the original American distributor, hacked down the film from 6 hours to 80 minutes. Napoleon went pretty much unnoticed until, after years of detective work tracking down missing footage, Brownlow presented his restoration in 1980. He also produced a trilogy of films on Charlie Chaplin, Buster Keaton, and Harold Lloyd, which you may have seen on public television. I asked him why he loved silent films.
I think it's because I was a kid at school, and they used to show us films every third weekend, and they couldn't afford talking pictures, and so they showed us silence. And although I wasn't then so impressed by the films themselves, what fascinated me was the fact that you could have a cinema in your own home, you could have a movie theater in your own home. And so I badgered my parents to get me a projector, and I got one for my 11th birthday. And only two films came with it, and they both only lasted 2 minutes. So I started hunting for more, and I found a whole pile of silent films in a shop off Baker Street, and brought them back and ran them to my parents. And my mother recognized Douglas Fairbanks and William S. Hart and Bessie Love, all the stars that she'd grown up with. So I thought, this must be worth something. So I went to the library, took out a book on the history of the cinema, and it fell open at a picture of the Douglas Fairbanks film I had. And so that persuaded me that there must be some value in these films. And gradually, I found more and more of them and discovered that they were extremely well made and extremely well photographed and actually more interesting as films than some of the stuff I was looking at in the local cinema.
It's so remarkable to me that you could have found footage, in junk stores and, you know, local fairs and things like that.
These were prepared for home movie use. They were abridged versions of complete features. And there were some very rare things on them. And, two of the reels I found were from a film called Napoleon. But the American films impressed me tremendously, both for their vitality and their technical perfection at a very early date. And so I started researching. As a matter of fact, I was supposed to do sport at school every afternoon. Instead of that, I went to the British Film Institute and began looking them up in old magazines. And that was a thrilling detective work because they had actually changed the titles for home movie use. So you had to find out what they were by a process of trial and error and just ploughing through all the releases till you found the description that matched.
Well, a little later, I want to get back to some of the detective work you've done in your collecting of movies, and we'll talk also about how you pieced together the epic Napoleon. But now I want to talk a little bit about your new book, Behind the Mask of Innocence. In your new book, you write that silent films are usually seen as representing an era of innocence, but they didn't really.
That's right. As you asked me what turned me on to silent films in the first place, when I became a filmmaker, I felt that they had been slandered, that people regarded them as jerky, flickering, technically inept curiosities, and I wanted to change that picture. And then as I researched them, I found that the prevailing mood was one of sentimental nonsense, hokum, as the Americans called it, melodrama, and that the however well made the film was, people tended to dismiss the story as being ridiculous and antique and quaint. And I felt that there must have been films made about social issues of the time. There must have been films about the immigrants, and there must have been films about women's suffrage and things like that. I must say it took a long time to find any evidence of them. But once I did, it turned into an avalanche, and I was absolutely staggered that so many films were made that we know so little about, and alas, most of them have been destroyed.
My guest is Kevin Brownlow, who's really one of the world's leading authorities on silent films, and his new book is called Behind the Mask of Innocence, Sex, Violence, Prejudice, Crime, Films of Social Conscience in the Silent Era. You know, the early silent movies raise a lot of interesting questions when you're talking about social films, because some of those films had to do with violence or sexuality. And this is the first time that people started asking questions about the degree of explicit sexuality or explicit crime that was going to be shown on the screen and what effect that would have on the people who saw it. What were some of the early ways those questions were raised, and what were some of the early fears that were expressed?
Well, right from the very start, when pictures first began to move, people started using them as an excuse. And the great train robbery of 1903, you can't get much earlier as far as story films go than that, already a young offender said, I was influenced by that picture to do this terrible crime. If I hadn't seen that film, I wouldn't have done it. and so the churchmen and the women's clubs, they started getting rather anxious about these pictures. And in 1906, I think it was, Harry Thaw shot the famous architect Stanford White when he discovered that his wife had been his mistress and before they were married. And this scandal made many people turned into a film. One of them, I think, came out 2 days after the event. And this series of films were the first to show the working class and immigrant audiences how the upper crust lived. And these were the people who made their laws and controlled their lives. And the middle classes were shocked that such things could be viewed by ordinary working people. And so it made them, the Thaw films made them shut theatres down.
So the earlier censorship that you're talking about is really what precedes the Hays Office and the Hollywood Production Code.
Yes, Hays didn't come in until 1921, 1922. And he was brought in because there was a series of scandals in Hollywood which threatened the family audience. The studio heads realized that unless they did something, they would lose that vital audience. And they did what the baseball people did when the World Series was fixed. They brought in a neutral figure who became known as the Tsar of all the Russias. And he really did a lot of harm because he emasculated stories which would otherwise have been getting stronger all the time, getting more interesting, more political and more engaged, and he made them blander. So that the great period of social films, where virtually every subject under the sun was tackled, was before his arrival up to 1921.
Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk more about silent movies. And my guest is Kevin Brownlow, and he's really one of the world's experts on silent films, and he has a new book on the subject called Behind the Mask of Innocence, Sex, Violence, Prejudice, Crime, Films of Social Conscience in the Silent Era. You might also know Kevin Brownlow as one of the people who restored the 1927 silent film classic Napoleon. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Kevin Brownlow is my guest. He's an expert on silent films. He restored the 1927 film, silent film classic Napoleon, and he's the author of a new book about social films of the silent film era called Behind the Mask of Innocence. I think all of the silent films were made on nitrate film, which has a fairly short shelf life. Can you explain what the problem is with nitrate film, the problems with storage and the problems with durability?
Yes, nitrate is known to be very inflammable. And as a result, people have created a scare. To such an extent, studios and private collectors have thrown it out. They won't have it anywhere near them in case it explodes like a hand grenade. But in fact, it's been an awful lot of nonsense being talked about it, because you drive around in a car with petrol in your tank, you don't set light to that, and it's no more dangerous than that. However, it can decompose because it's got animal fat in its makeup, and this is the most distressing aspect of it. It was expected to last 50 years, and the silent era itself was history 60 years ago. So we're talking about film which has miraculously lasted, and there's not a, you know, about two-thirds of the silent era is already lost. So we're talking about the remaining third. Some of that has already been copied by archives onto safety stock. Now, the rest of it must be done, because this is the last decade of nitrate. And if we don't do it, posterity will regard it as one of the greatest cultural crimes.
Well, I think one of the things you're proving is that we really don't fully know what the silent film era was like, since so much of the movies have been lost.
Particularly those years before the 20s started. We have, during that period, there was something called the three-reeler that was very popular. And the three-reeler, because it was an awkward length, was never kept, and hardly any of them survive, and yet the most interesting subjects were made in that peculiar length. It lasted, you know, about half an hour, 40 minutes, depending the speed you ran it at. And some remarkable pictures were produced, and some series about capital versus labor and about the early gangsters and the patent medicine racket. And it's absolutely fascinating.
You know, speaking to you is really getting me enthusiastic about going to the video store and renting some silent films, and more of them are coming out on video. I'll be honest with you, I've never rented a silent film on video. It always seems like it will be an incomplete experience watching it on a small screen without music, or at least without live music. I wonder if you've had the experience of watching silence on video and what you think of it.
Well, I think watching films on video is an incomplete experience. I think a whole generation has lost the thrill of seeing a picture in the cinema as it was meant to be seen, with an audience reacting strongly to it and adding that reaction to their own. And then they look at the same film. If you look at the same film on video, it's never anything like the same. However, there are some excellent examples on video. In fact, my partner and I, my partner David Gill and I, have prepared some, including Ben-Hur, the 1925 Raymond Navarro version, and Carl Davis has written a fantastic score for it, the Garbo film Flesh and the Devil, quite a number of them, King Vidor's The Crowd, and King Vidor's Show People, which is one of the funniest pictures of that period. So there are some fine pictures available on video, but they should be done with the best possible quality and also the best quality score. And that sometimes lets it down. Sometimes you get a silent film which is ghastly quality in every sense. The music, too, is just a piano. But that brings me back to the thing that got me going in the first place, that it was the technical perfection of these films which amazed me, that photographically they were always extremely good. And it's the copying over the years that has made them look, he's given them that murky look. And alas, videotape is not the ideal medium for them. You should really see a really good print projected with a cart, with an arc, or with a really good light behind it on a big screen, and preferably live music.
You restored the 1927 French silent film Napoleon, which was directed by Abel Gance. I'm sure a lot of detective work went into finding the film. I think you'd said that you saw the first part of it when you were around 11 years old, but that was just a small, just a couple of minutes that you saw, right?
No, it was a couple of reels, which would have lasted 20, 25 minutes, and it was enough to convince me that this was some of the finest filmmaking I'd ever seen. I go out on a limb and say it was the finest filmmaking I'd ever seen. And if the rest of the film is as good as that, then it, you know, I must get the rest of it. Well, it took years and years and years, but it was one of the most extraordinary things. The more I found, the better the picture got, until the version that we're running in Europe now is 5 hours 13.
Well, that's longer than the version that was in the States a few years ago, isn't it?
Considerably longer, yes. Yes, it is. And we're constantly finding more.
Where are you finding more and more footage from this?
Well, now footage is being dredged up from the archives of the Cinémathèque Française, and is not a great deal, but there's another 5 minutes to be sneaked in somehow, if we can afford to do it. But every time you put more footage in, you have to pay to change the score. And if I could tell you that it costs £2,000 just to Xerox the score, you can see how expensive it is.
At this point, is your version of Napoleon longer than what Abel Gance originally had in mind?
No, it isn't. Gance was forced to show a shorter version at the premiere, and it was about 3.5 hours. It sort of approximated to the version that's shown in America. After that, he showed an expanded version, and that, as far as we can gather, was more than 7 hours. So still quite a lot of it lost, and I don't think it'll ever be found at this late date. People think it's going to be an effort to sit through it, but it isn't. It sweeps you along with it, because the more you put back, the more explanation is given, the more innovation you see, and the more exciting it becomes.
What are you working on now?
David Gill and I are now working on a documentary for American Masters on D.W. Griffith.
That should be very interesting. What are you focusing on?
Well, the whole career. It's going to be 3 programs. And so we're desperately trying to find people who worked with him and who knew him. So if anyone is listening to this who worked with Griffith and we haven't interviewed you, please let us know.
Okay. Given Brownlow, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much indeed.
Silent film historian Kevin Brownlow. His latest book is Behind the Mask of Innocence. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel's with us. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Terry. We have news today of the warning from the White House to Iraq that Iraqi aircraft flying in the northern part of the country above the 36th parallel, according to the White House, will be fired at and shot down by the United States. That is a clarification and a strengthening of the U.S. position in support of the Kurds in northern Iraq. Also today, a special report from NPR's correspondent Howard Berkus on Las Vegas, and that city, one of the fastest growing in the country, that city's need for more water and the problems it's encountering in trying to bring water in from rural communities.
Thanks, Robert. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. For much of his career, Polish journalist and author Ryszard Kapuściński seemed to have a homing device for danger, covering third world countries in turmoil. He now lives in Warsaw. In his new book about his experiences abroad, Kapuściński writes, "The only chance small countries from the third world have of evoking a lively international interest is when they decide to shed blood." Book critic John Leonard says Kapuściński's writing about other countries also offers insight into his own.
For 22 years, Ryszard Kapuściński covered the Third World for the Polish news agency. From the Congo to Honduras, 27 coups, civil wars and revolutions, and still counting. His career as the only Eastern European foreign correspondent wholly trusted by Western reporters came to an abrupt end after he supported Solidarity. He wrote astonishing books instead. The Emperor, about Haile Selassie in Ethiopia, and The Shah of Shahs, the best book yet on the revolution in Iran. The Soccer War is a collection of pieces from his wandering years, cut and shaped as if to hallucinate the pride and waste of human material, the scorpions and hyenas of history aborting. He calls it a non-existent or unwritten book, and stops periodically to tell us what he should be writing instead. But the book we're looking at has its secrets too, as limpid and as scary as it is, and sometimes very funny, and not always just political. The Soccer War seems almost to be composed in symbolic cipher, as if to smuggle a conscience back into Poland. so brilliantly observed at the borders, in deserts and jungles, in refugee camps, Kapuscinski's Third World is also a kind of metafiction, peopled with moralizing Aesops and ancient mariners. Not just in Africa, but in Warsaw too, at the Foreign Ministry, there are witch doctors. Here are dazzling pen portraits of doomed Third World leaders like Nkrumah of Ghana and Benbella of Algeria and Lumumba of the Congo. Here are the fearful and sometimes absurd bloodlettings of civil wars in Mozambique and Nigeria. Over the Sahara, he tells us, the stars are enormous. They sway above the sand like giant chandeliers. The light of those stars is green. Night in the Sahara is as green as a meadow. We go to political rallies. A rally in Africa, he says, is always a people's holiday, like a harvest festival. The witch doctors cast spells. The imams read the Quran. The orchestras play jazz. We also go into the bars. An African bar, he says, is the Roman Forum, the main square in a medieval market town, Robespierre's Parisian wine cellar, a club and a pawn shop, a bordello, and a party cell. We meet refugee peasants and starving nomads. We are told by this artful death dodger of the universal presence in Latin America of the Baroque. Baroque not only as a style of aesthetics and thought, but also as a general commitment to excess and eclecticism. We are also told, out of nowhere, that, in general, I am no enthusiast of furniture and regard as the ideal house the Japanese one, where there is nothing besides the walls, the ceiling, the floor, and the ichiban. Furniture divides man from man. People cower behind furniture as though behind barricades. They disappear into furniture like birds into holes. And on the Mexican desert with him, we talk to an ancient Indian who is listening on a wind-up gramophone to a record that keeps repeating, Rio Manzanares, let me cross. Papa, shouts the reporter, there is no river here. After a bit, the Indian replies, son, I am the river, and I can't cross myself. To get their subversive point across, modernists like Borges, Calvino, and Stanislaw Lem wrote reviews of imaginary books. Kapuscinski went to the Third World to write about a Poland everybody else was pretending didn't really exist.
John Leonard is media critic for CBS Sunday Morning. He reviewed The Soccer War by Richard Kapuscinski. Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our program is produced this week by Fred Landerl. Our engineers are Audrey Vablaitis, Joyce Lieberman, and Dan Laughlin. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional grants are provided by the National Endowment for the Arts and Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs. 1-800-8-TALBOTS. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Should the First Amendment protect the right of one student to harass another with racial epithets? Many universities have instituted language codes to protect students against such insults. On the next Fresh Air, the debate over free speech and language codes. Also, rocker Graham Parker. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.